Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. When it comes to buying those big-ticket items, it makes sense to shop around, maybe check out a review or two. But when a review's a little too good...
Wow! Retailer XYZ really knows pants, and my inseams have never let me down. Nobody talks like that.
They don't? But you never know. There might be people out there who are really into a particular store. And if you're like me, that probably means you're always on the lookout for a sale. But maybe it's not just the idea of getting a new pair of pants that's driving you to the mall. Maybe it's your brain.
What it tells us about your behavior is that when a bargain comes up, you're going to act on that bargain. In theory, we could use that to predict whether you're going to buy something or not.
We've got that story and a whole lot more coming up on a firecracker edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It's Independence Weekend, time to rally around Old Glory and the barbecue. But in a time of war, it's also appropriate to honor the service of our men and women in uniform, even as many of them struggle to make ends meet back at home. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveint.com/retirement.
Happy 4th of July weekend, everybody. For many of us, it's a chance to relax and enjoy the outdoors, hot dog in hand. But soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere in the world don't have it so easy. As if they don't have enough to deal with fighting wars, many service members also face personal finance challenges that threaten their economic security. Some of it is due to ignorance about managing a budget, but other hurdles could trip up even the savviest financial planner. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes us to a California National Guard base.
Helicopter pilots practice taking off and landing here at the Joint Forces Training Base at Los Alamitos. The military is all about specialization. But while young recruits learn to aim missiles with pinpoint accuracy, they suffer from too little practice keeping their personal finances on target. That was the case for Marco Velez.
When I first joined the Army, I didn't know how to write a check. I got my first bank account when I joined. So I'm in line in basic training at the PX. The lady had to tell me at the cash register how to write out a check, and everybody was kind of pissed off because we were in a rush.
Now he's a contractor with the California National Guard, where he educates service members about available benefits. Cheryl Courtright works with him at the Family Readiness Program. She says some obstacles are cultural. For example, if the male breadwinner exclusively handles the finances, Courtright says the family can be lost when he ships overseas.
We've had it where we've literally had to walk a family through, this is what a check is. There's money in a bank. This is where your bank is. This is the balance. This is how you read your bank statements.
Courtright also counsels young enlisted guys, offering a boot camp for budgeting.
You have a new baby. What's the priorities here? Do you need that flat screen TV, or do you need to make sure that the baby's got a crib, formula, diapers, and food?
The personal finance challenges are very different for reservists and National Guard. These folks are typically older, and many have good-paying civilian jobs. Courtright knows from experience she had to reassess her own financial priorities when her husband was activated.
He made more money at that point in the civilian world than he did in the National Guard.
Jerry Newberry with the Veterans of Foreign Wars, or VFW, says it's a common challenge for National Guard and reservists.
That steady stream of income falls dramatically. Someone who's earning $50,000 or $60,000 a year is all of a sudden earning less than $20,000.
The situation can be especially tough on small business owners. Again, Marco Velez.
My friend Scott, he used to be part of an air conditioning company, and he got activated, and he ended up losing half his business because of that. He was making six figures a year. And then when he got activated, he was only making maybe 45.
On top of that, service members face various bureaucratic black holes. Paperwork might not get processed, so new troops could go a month or two without a paycheck. The VFW's Jerry Newberry cites one particularly egregious catch-22. It happened to a National Guard unit from Minnesota, which had been deployed overseas longer than any other unit.
In the entire military, these people were deployed for just short of 2 years and one day short of being able to obtain education benefits from the military, from the government. One day short.
Other times, troops may be eligible for certain benefits, but they don't know it. Marco Velez touts an Army program.
Active Duty Army has a savings program where if a soldier saves $10,000, they'll match 10%. So that's a free grant.
Other grassroots organizations also offer help. The VFW got more than $1 million from tool company Vermont American to fund a financial assistance program called Unmet Needs. In Orange County, Habitat for Humanity is testing a pilot program. Cheryl Courtwright says Habitat is building 13 homes specifically designed for disabled vets and available with 0% loans.
I don't know wherever else they can find a 0% interest loan to help disabled soldiers and veterans. It's an amazing program.
Despite these opportunities, soldiers can be their own worst financial enemies. They are often too proud to ask for help or wait until it's too late. Plus, unsophisticated service members face dangerous domestic predators, falling prey to expensive life insurance ripoffs and other scams. Coming off a helicopter and dodging bullets, the last thing a soldier needs is the added stress of worrying about bankruptcy. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
And we're interested in hearing from active duty and veteran soldiers about what kind of financial hurdles they're facing or have overcome. If you'd like to share your story, go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on the link for military stories.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
If you're planning a quick getaway this summer, maybe looking for somewhere new to stay, you might check out some online hotel reviews. All the major travel websites have them, Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz. There's hotels.com, wherestostay.com, mytravelguide.com, and there are similar sites for other goods and services. But the reviews are often all over the map. Lenora Chu went browsing for clues on how to vet and sift through so many diverse opinions.
If you've had doubts about some of the reviews you read online, you're not the only one. You never know who's writing what and why, says Los Angeles Times consumer affairs columnist David Lazarus. Anyone can post a nasty review under the name John S. or Crystal M. So did they really hate the service, or are they just seeking personal revenge?
Ex-wives, ex-husbands, disgruntled former employees. I mean, these are the bread and butter of the negative postings out there. And that's a very scary aspect of this.
On the other end, a business owner's best friend or brother might have posted that glowing review, says Lazarus. Perhaps it was even a corporate plant. Fake reviews can be painfully obvious.
Wow. Retailer XYZ really knows pants, and my inseams have never let me down. Nobody talks like that. So when you see that sort of language, you know that that's probably not the real thing.
A Nielsen survey recently found consumers trust word-of-mouth recommendations the most. But when it came to getting those opinions online, the level of trust dropped 17 points. So how do you sort through hundreds of reviews to get the straight story? Lazarus says that takes a little time and some common sense. Read as many reviews as possible and factor out the extremes.
It's the ones that seem to walk down the middle, that can see the good and the bad, that for me tend to be the most trustworthy.
It also helps to hone in on websites that line up with your own values.
And that's the real trick. Once you find those sites, you should cling to them because you have found a community of which you are a member.
The online review site Yelp even encourages users to latch onto favorite reviewers and to read their profiles. Knowing a Yelper's hometown or favorite movie might hint at whether you'll like the same sushi joint. Also, check out the new summary charts for each establishment reviewed. One shows you how scores change over time. Another displays an aggregate of all the reviewers' star ratings, says Yelp CEO Jeremy Stoppelman.
How are the reviews dispersed? You know, how many 5 stars are there? How many 3 stars? which is also really useful data in trying to understand how this business is performing.
At San Francisco's Chancellor Hotel, manager Wes Tyler spends hours on TripAdvisor reading reviews that his guests write. He's seen everything from A++ to manager's a jerk. His advice to consumers? Trust an opinion when several reviewers are saying the same thing.
These are not your friends or your neighbors or people that know you and you don't know them. Take it all with a grain of salt and look for consistency. A common theme, noisy, 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 or, you know, walls are thin, walls are thin, walls are thin.
Tyler's proud that TripAdvisor reviewers consistently rate his hotel in San Francisco's top 10. But that's taken a lot of hard work and graciousness. In the rare instance that the hotel didn't live up to its billing, he's offered a free night's stay. In Los Angeles, I'm Lenora Chu for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, our theme for today, this Independence Weekend, is financial independence. It is that time of year when a lot of students graduate from college, like your oldest son.
Yeah, and all I got to say is, how dare he?
Well, hopefully he's learned from dear old dad about how to deal financially. What words of money wisdom have you provided for him and might you have for today's graduate?
Well, Tess, would you like me to make a commencement address?
No, I'm not going to give you that much time.
All right. Well, you know, I have to say, nothing original. I think the best advice really is find what you love, pursue your passions. And of course, my favorite, think like a stock.
I was with you till that last point. Maybe you've been doing this too long.
Well, that may be true, but here's what I mean. Look, no one can pierce the fog of the future, and you're a young person and you're thinking about jobs and careers. But, you know, you can't pierce the fog of the future when you're thinking about buying a stock or a mutual fund. So what do we tell people to do? To use the financial jargon, what's the relationship between the potential rewards and the potential risks? You've got to find what you love and pursue it. You don't ever want to abandon that search. But there was this famous commencement address by Steve Jobs of Apple. And at the end, he said, stay hungry, stay foolish, and I would add, think risk.
Okay, well, let's talk practicalities then. I mean, if you're graduating from school, let's say we're talking undergraduates at this point, because graduates, I think, tend to have a little more focus and really know what they want to do. That's why they're going to law school or medical school or business school. But if you're an undergraduate and you're just leaving school for the first time, and perhaps you've actually never had to balance a checkbook, I mean, all this stuff has been taken care of for you for a while. Maybe not. How do you get to the point where you feel comfortable managing your own money?
Well, I think one of the important things is that you are young, you are not your parents. Where young people often get into trouble is to try to live the living standard of their parents rather than the living standard of a student. You don't want to take on credit card debt. You can make a lot of mistakes, but if you don't take on credit card debt, the penalties are less. But when you're thinking about your job or your career, one of the reasons why I talk about thinking about risk is we get so many emails and calls from people who have taken on so much debt to pursue a career, and it's clear that they didn't think about what's the downside. It doesn't mean that you don't take on the debt. It doesn't mean that you don't pursue that career. But it does mean, if you're going to take on a lot of debt to pursue that dream, make that investment, what's the downside, and can you live with it?
Okay. The Straight Story, and perhaps an honorary degree from our own Chris Farrell.
Thank you.
Coming up next, if you can't say no to a sale, you can blame your gray matter. We'll explore the science behind shopping.
Stanford t-shirt. $4. That's a good deal. Yes or no? She doesn't want the Stanford t-shirt.
Yeah, I'm a wildcat, not a cardinal. Stay tuned for more Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Ever wish somebody could peer inside your brain and tell you why you do the things you do, make the decisions you make? Well, in the field of behavioral economics, that's exactly what they're trying to do. All kinds of experiments using technology to take pictures of your body while you're making saving and spending decisions. Me? I still shake my head over my own and others' penchant for going out and buying all kinds of stuff we don't need, especially during markdown season. I admit it. I'm a sucker for a bargain.
Get a great deal on these
50% off all
$12.99 for a limited time.
Spectacular 15-hour clearance sale.
Not in the flea market shopping, secondhand shoe-wearing sense of the word, but there's nothing like a sale to get me in the door. 20% off your next purchase. Sold! Whether I need that sixth pair of black pants or not.
Lowest prices of the season.
Save 20 to 40% on
it. Get a $10 reward for every...
You may say I have no one but myself to blame, but you might be surprised what part of myself I can blame. But before we get to that, I got some insight during a trip to Stanford University, where researchers are using brain scans to watch people's gray matter on shopping.
Okay, you're doing great. We're going to start up the functional part of the scan where you'll be shopping. If you're ready to start, give me an uh-huh.
That's Daniel Wu, assistant to Stanford psychologist Brian Knutson. They put a wad of dollars in my hand, stuck me inside an MRI machine that was as comfortable as a coffin, and flashed pictures of products. When I'm not interested in what's on screen, my brain's kind of boring.
Stanford t-shirt. $4. That's a good deal. Yes or no? She doesn't want the Stanford t-shirt.
But when there was something I liked, Brian Knutson watched one part of my brain light up the scan.
The next item? Ooh, is the Lord of the Rings trilogy DVD box set. Price $19, one of our higher priced items. And she decided yes.
See, I know a bargain when I see one. That boxed set goes for $65 on Amazon. Here's the thing. It's not the bill-paying part of my brain that's at work here. It's the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, the part that's also activated during sex. Knutson says my mesial prefrontal cortex got involved, too. Again, more emotion than logic there. After many more choices like these...
Okay, Jess, that's it. We're going to come rescue you now.
We were done. This particular Stanford study looked at bargain hunting, and when I spoke to Knutson a few weeks later, he said I was a good subject. Brian Knutson, what did you find in my brain as I was shopping?
Your brain looks very nice.
Thank you.
We found, you know, it seems to be functioning quite well.
Maybe a little too well. It seems my brain consistently lit up before I could even say, I'll take it. The buy it part of my brain was ahead of the let me check my bank account part. In other words, logic had nothing to do with it.
What it tells us about your behavior is that when a bargain comes up, you're going to act on that bargain. In theory, we could use that, those patterns of activation, to predict whether you're going to buy something or not.
Predict whether I'll buy something? Let's hope Madison Avenue doesn't get a hold of this. But there was a sliver of good news for my credit card balance.
When we look at your neural response in an area that we call the nucleus accumbens, we see less of a response overall there to the products than we usually see in our students.
So I'm less impulsive than their previous lab rats. But just to assuage my shopping guilt a little more, I asked Knutson how this brain mapping could eventually help us understand and even change our behaviors. Do I just need more willpower?
Willpower, I'm sure, plays a role. But we're trying to use these tools now to focus on decisions that don't always align neatly with people's self-reports of what they want.
And is it possible for you to say that at this point? What's going on in that situation?
It's not, but that's where we're headed. We're, in addition to being interested in, you know, consumer behavior, we're also interested in mental disorders. And one of those areas that we focus on is addiction.
Uh-oh. I guess the first of my next 12 steps is ignoring all those commercials. If you're curious, we've got an image of my brain scan on our website. It's marketplace.org. Delinquency rates are way up on everything from home loans and credit cards to car payments. Cash-strapped Americans are looking for money anywhere they can find it. Last year, nearly 20% of employees took out loans from their 401ks, and the numbers are climbing. Josephine Bennett tells us once you tap into retirement funds, it can be really tough to pay yourself back.
There are two ways you can take money out of your 401k. You can take what's called a hardship withdrawal, or you can take out a loan. To qualify for a hardship withdrawal, you have to be facing what the IRS calls immediate and heavy financial needs, things like college tuition, medical expenses, buying your first home, or foreclosure. But if you're just short on funds, you can take out a low-interest loan against your 401k. Most employers allow people to take out up to $50,000. You have 5 years to pay it back, and those deductions come right out of your paycheck. 43-year-old Anjanette Rumney worked as a nurse in the same Macon, Georgia hospital for 15 years. During that time, she was a regular contributor to her 401k. The longer she worked, the more she saved.
You know, I started off with just like 5%, and then I went up to 7%. So I got up to about like 10% that I was saving, and then the medical center would match that. So I had a pretty good, you know, amount in there.
At one point, she had close to $100,000 in her retirement account. But as a single mother with two boys, she still struggled to make ends meet. So she borrowed money from her 401k to pay off bills. But then she changed jobs. And here's the catch. If you leave your job, the government only gives you 90 days to pay back the loan. If you don't, you'll be hit with taxes and a penalty. What seemed like a good idea became a bitter pill this year when she paid her taxes. Anjanette lost nearly half the amount in taxes and penalties.
As we all know that our economy, everything else is going up and your paycheck isn't. And then when I didn't get my money back that I was used to getting from my income taxes because I had to pay those penalties, you know, it was like, wow.
Anjanette does not regret her decision. She says she needed to do it to avoid a disaster down the road. 57-year-old John McIntyre has been a victim of corporate downsizing twice, and both times he's qualified for the 401k hardship withdrawal.
I had to do it. There was no other way. I really couldn't take out any loans at the time. When was I going to start to work? Was it going to be next week, next month, 3 months, 5 months? And being at the age I was at, I was close to 50. It was much more difficult to find a job.
As a result of those withdrawals, he'll have to work a lot longer than he expected. He's just starting to put a little back in savings. Certified financial planner Steve Rosenberg knows people often have to make tough choices under fire, but he cautions his clients not to let emotions get in the way, even if they're about to lose a home.
If you are facing foreclosure and effectively the house is worth less than what you owe on it, then do you want to take the money out of your 401k, which is protected from suits and things like that, and do you instead want to just walk away from the house?
Rosenberg cautions his clients against borrowing from their 401ks. He points to the current housing crisis as an important lesson.
The problem is that people are treating their 401ks like they treat like a bank. And we know that's a bad idea because there's already a model that shows how bad an idea that is. And that's people who have taken money out of their houses, refinanced, took out the money, spent it, and they've blown their equity in their houses. You know, if they take it out of their 401k, they end up blowing their 401k too.
But with $49 billion in outstanding 401k loans, it's clear that many Americans are willing to take that risk. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Josephine Bennett for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
All right, it is that time in the show where we get personal, when we answer all those pesky money questions that you, the listener, have. We also call it Stump the Feral. Of course, our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is never stumped, are you, Chris?
Oh, yeah, I think you got me a few times, but pesky? I don't know about pesky.
All right, let's go ahead and hit the phones. Our first call is from Aaron in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
All right. So what do you do there in Indianapolis?
I'm a radiographer.
A radiographer. Is that medicine, I assume?
Yeah, I take x-rays. And I'm in school to get my degree for to do MRIs and CTs.
Oh, so you're in grad school?
Yes. I'm trying to get my master's in health sciences. That's going to be my focus.
Well, what's your question for Chris today? Sounds like you've got everything handled.
Oh, gosh, no.
No. Oh, okay.
Well, my life, as far as financially, has a lot of ups and downs through my life. Well, I'm 40 years old, and when I was in my 20s and 30s, at times when I had really good jobs, I did really well on paying my bills. And then when I didn't have really good jobs and I was in school, I didn't do very well on paying my bills if I paid them. Some of my bills, I have gone to court because they want their money, which I don't blame them. I want mine too. So I have a couple of judgments against me for these credit card bills.
Credit card debt. No, all right.
Yeah. And my question is, now that I have graduated and able to get those bills taken care of, should I call those collection agencies and say, I won't pay this amount so I can clear it off, even though I know it'll be considered a charge off?
What kind of money are we talking about here?
One is almost $3,000, and then the other one is $5,400.
Do you actually want to eventually pay off the entire sum?
Well, I don't agree with the entire sum because of all the interest that's accrued. I agree with the amount that I was charged against when we went to court. That's why I was wondering if it was okay to make that phone call and see if they would just take the original amount, because I could have that in a month.
And that is perfectly okay to do. Go ahead and make that phone call. But if you're going to actually negotiate a deal, you need to get everything in writing, because people can say whatever they want over the phone. They don't have to follow through.
Chris, if she gets an agreement with the collection company to take a lesser amount than what they say she owes, isn't that called a charge off? And then how does that reflect on her credit score?
It will have an impact on her credit score. Now, we don't have the impact that we used to have in the old days, where it could be fairly dramatic. But again, it still will have a, it will be a negative item on your file. But it's not that big. And frankly, I think that there's this point for everybody where they have to sort of make a certain type of decision. You know, do they want to pay off this debt or not? I tend to believe people should pay off their debts, even if it does have an impact on their credit score. And that is an approach that people take.
All right. So, Aaron, do you think you'll be making that phone call?
Oh, definitely. It's my debt and I want to pay it.
All right. Well, let us know how it went.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
No problem.
Well, if you've made some money mistakes and you're trying to redeem yourself, let us help. Do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Wen wrote in from Boston, Massachusetts. She is a 24-year-old law student, and she's been inspired by the show. Yay. To consider switching her Roth IRA mutual fund to a socially responsible index fund like the Domini Fund. And this is a question we get a lot from folks regarding socially responsible mutual funds. She did some research to compare her current fund to the Domini Fund, and she found that her current fund is a better performer on the earnings chart, but it also has higher expense ratios and higher fees. Boo.
Mm. So
her question really is there a tool out there that will allow her to do some sort of bottom line comparison between the funds?
Tessa, I have two websites that she can visit. Now, what we can compare and come up with concrete numbers are fees, the impact of fees over time, mm-hmm. what the return is going to be. You know, you and I could have a good conversation thinking, well, I think this is the right part of the market
right.
to be in or long term. But we have no idea.
No, it's up to the market.
It's up to the market. But we can compare those fees. Now, the first one is a new name. We used to call it the NASD. Now it's FINRA, right?
Right. And in full disclosure, I should say that they are an underwriter of this program.
Well, they have the Mutual Fund Expense Analyzer. And what's nice about this is you can compare the expenses, fees of up to three funds. You can also go to the Securities and Exchange Commission website, sec.gov. And at that website, they have a mutual fund cost comparison calculator. You can see the impact of fees. I think it's great. This is a great question. And it's important for people to realize that these tools do exist to compare fees. And just as returns compound over time, we talk about that compounding effect, fees compound over time, too.
All right. Well, if you need a question answered, please do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Certainly this holiday weekend, many folks are feeling a little patriotic, proudly wearing the red, white, and blue. But some people have a different color scheme in mind, more like black and blue. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we step into the ring with a pro wrestler.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear. The fact remains that I am an Olympic gold medalist, TNA World Heavyweight Champion, and I am better than you.
My name is Kurt Angle, TNA World Heavyweight Champion, and Olympic gold medalist, and 12-time world champion, but who's counting? As an amateur wrestler, my brothers were all very good. I wasn't. I actually, my first year, I was 1-16, lost 16 matches. Actually, I was 2-16. One of the matches I won by forfeit. The child didn't show up. But every year, I got better. And what do you know? You know, in the long run, I'm the one that won the state title. I'm the one that won the national titles. I won 6 national titles. When I won the Olympic gold medal, that's all I strive for my whole life. So the next morning I woke up and thought, what am I going to do now? You know, I was lost. And I tried sportscasting. I did that for a year. I didn't like it. Finally, I started watching wrestling, pro wrestling. And I thought, I'm not quite done being an athlete yet. Being an amateur wrestler, you're taught to show no emotion, go for the pinfall as quickly as you can and get it done. In pro wrestling, you're taught to show emotion, include the crowd to the match, tell a story in that match. And that was the hardest thing for me to learn, was the psychology of professional wrestling. You got to go out there and have the right psychology to get the fans behind the match, whether you're a good guy or you're a heel, a bad guy. And I was able to pick that up within the first year. A hard day for me usually starts out at 5 in the morning and flying to the UK, 14 hours, probably doing about 3 hours of media tour, going straight to the gym, workout, get my workout in, watching every single match so I can watch what every single wrestler's doing, because I'm not just a talent, I'm a teacher as well. Do my match and then know that we're probably going to have to drive 4 hours to do the next show the next morning. When you have tours like that that last 9 or 10 days, you start to get pretty run down. They pay me very well. How about this? I've made up to $3 million in a year, and right now, money's not that important to me, but I still make about 7 figures. I am never in character when I'm outside on the streets. I am always very polite. The fans get it. They know that the person on TV isn't particularly the person that you're going to see on the streets, but a lot of big guys that are very dominant in wrestling, they weigh 270 pounds and they're 6'3", and you know, they look like monsters, and they start buying into their character and believing that they are monsters, when really it takes me 10 seconds to take them out. Those are the kind of guys I feel bad for. If you really believe in your character, then there's something really wrong.
Yeah. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Julie Miller. Coming up, we profile a new financial playground for Americans and watch it drain their bank accounts.
We're moving tomorrow. You know, and then you get here and you live here and reality sets in. You go, oh, it's expensive here. It's expensive to go out.
And how about the little number crunching 101? We'll look at how to get over math anxiety. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Everything in Dubai is about being the biggest, the best, the record-breakingest. Perhaps you've heard about the indoor ski resort, the world's tallest building, a giant map of the world made out of artificial islands. Dubai is billing itself as a place where dreams come true, and the pitch is working. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to Dubai to be part of the dream and to live and work there. But can the desert paradise make good on its promises, or are people in for a rude awakening when they arrive? As Sean Cole tells us, it depends who you ask.
A map of the world made out of islands is nothing. That thing was finished back in January, or the first phase of it anyway. And 9 days later, the state-owned company that built it, Nakheel, unveiled its latest project at an annual tourism conference.
Nakheel brought you the world. Now, we take you to the universe.
That's right. Islands shaped like planets and galaxies.
Now, being in real estate, now, there are certain moments in life you come to a place and you're saying, wow. And Dubai is certainly a place of wows.
Robert Lee is the executive director of Nakheel. He's also really representative of the new Dubai, a Korean guy who grew up in Canada and landed a senior position at a government company.
Dubai has been a desert place. There is no natural monument. Dubai doesn't have the Grand Canyon. Okay. The value we have with the world islands, it's not the real estate. It's how people talk about Dubai.
The dream of Dubai is living in a place that builds islands shaped like stuff. The dream of Dubai is skiing for a couple of hours at the mall and then hitting the beach the same day. The dream of Dubai is living in a luxury villa by a man-made lake. But some people who've moved here will tell you that the villas and the dream are pretty shoddy. People like Jan Robertson, a housewife from the UK. She's had a lot of trouble with her house.
Quality's really poor, yeah. Water pouring in when it rains. And then there's the water tanks. They burst on a regular basis every 3-4 months.
I talked with Jan at a country club where she has breakfast with friends every Wednesday. They're mainly the wives of guys in the oil, construction, and financial industries, Brits and Americans alike. They talk and laugh and sometimes complain. And the day I was there, Jan and her friend Heather Johnson complained that the dream of Dubai is just something their husband's companies told them so they'd move there. This is Heather.
They do like a wine and dine. Bring the wife out on us, you know. We'll take her out and we'll show her a good time. So the wives come and go, wow, this place is great. We're moving tomorrow. You know, and then you get here and you live here and reality sets in. You go, oh, it's expensive here. It's expensive to go out. It's expensive.
Plus, their husbands have to work 6 days a week. There's no genuine culture here, Jan says. The British school her kids are in is good, but she's paying a lot for that, too.
So you don't think the dream of Dubai matches with the reality?
No, I don't at all. Not once you actually live here.
Nonetheless, people are climbing all over each other to live here. A report from the Dubai financial group Schwa Capital says that the population of this city grew more than 50% between 2000 and 2005. And one of the reasons it gave was pretty simple, almost sweet. It said people just like the Dubai story.
They love it. They love it. It was a desert, and they made something of this desert. I mean,
Rania Afifi wrote that report.
There are trees in the desert. They managed to bring down the temperatures here by 10 degrees Celsius. That's incredible. Any architect with a really funky idea can come here and realize his dream. They motivate you. Why not love the story?
It sounds like you really love the story.
I do like the Dubai story. I do.
And because so many people want to be part of the story, the property market is through the roof, which has led to another aspect of the dream. You can make a lot of money here by flipping apartments or renting them out. Unfortunately, developers can't keep up with demand, and most of the residential projects in Dubai were delayed last year, including a Nakheel building that this woman invested in. She didn't want her name used.
There was no compensation. It was a year late.
I mean, did you say, hey, like...
Well, I think you don't like to ruffle too many feathers because we are guests of this country. You've got to be a little bit careful.
What could happen? They could toss you out?
Well, possibly, yeah.
We probably have the largest customer relations center.
Again, Robert Lee of Nakheel.
And we treat everybody on the same basis. So please come and ruffle feathers. And the flip side, you should have asked her, how much money she has made in capital appreciation from our building, that should answer the question.
Actually, we did talk about that.
I've made 100% profit.
So the problems are outweighed by the benefit.
Yes, at the moment. But you've got to watch the bits in the middle, you know, otherwise they're going to outgrow their popularity then.
But for now, Dubai is the most popular kid on the block. And not just among expats who have money. There's a whole other Dubai dream that we haven't mentioned yet. One that has more to do with survival. Hundreds of thousands of the foreigners in Dubai are here to build the luxury apartments and villas and islands shaped like stuff. They're the South Asian laborers who are literally hammering the city's promise of prosperity together. For them, the dream of Dubai is just making a little money to send back home. And it is very little.
That's one of the main things that gets me down about Dubai.
This is Jan Robertson again.
And you see bus fulls of them, you know, and they've empty eyes. It sounds strange. You just look at their eyes, they're just empty. Sad, really sad. But that's how Dubai's been built, yeah? That's what they rely on.
And it'll probably be that way until Dubai has to adjust its boomtown mentality into something more sustainable, something more realistic, and less like a dream. In Dubai, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we've got an email from Jeffrey in College Station, Texas. He considers himself what's called a lazy investor.
Which is a good thing, because typically that means you own like index funds and you're not a very active trader. So it can be a very smart approach.
Well, that's exactly what he says he does. He says he uses index funds and a percentage of assets for what he hopes is a balanced portfolio. But he wants to know how often he should rebalance to these predetermined percentages. First of all, let's give a really basic definition of what lazy investing is.
A lazy investor just wants to be smart over the long haul about how much they have in stocks, how much they have in bonds, and then every once in a while check in and make sure that their fund is doing okay. So it's a real focus on, jargon term here, asset allocation. How much in stocks, how much in bonds, and then once you've really put all your work and research into that, then you're just doing some monitoring, no buying, no selling, no trading.
But how about this question of how often you check it and change things?
Okay. Let's say you were 50% stocks, 50% bonds. We're going to keep it real simple. And just because of the way the world has worked, you're now 60% stocks, 40% bonds. You want to get back to your 50-50. That's what all the rebalancing does. That's okay. What he's asking about. So you can do it once a year. Now, usually for most people, that's not enough. Some people do it quarterly. And then other people are a little more active. They'll typically say, if my asset allocation gets out of whack by 10%, that's when I make my move. So it's not by the calendar. It's by how much the markets are moving. If I get a 10% move, then I'm going to go in there and do my rebalancing.
All right. Well, whether you are a lazy investor or, Lord help us, a stock market daredevil, let us help with your portfolio. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Sean is with us from beautiful Honolulu, Hawaii. How's it hanging there, Sean?
Things are going well, Tess. Thanks.
Yeah. How's the surf?
Surf's nice.
Can I come visit?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I understand that you have a question today that you're asking on behalf of your mother. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, my mom went to a conference where they told her about some business opportunities, as it were. And when she told me about them, she was really excited, and they sounded a little bit fishy to me. They told her about a couple of things. One was a way to buy tax liens through, you know, their special program. And another one was a way to protect your assets through something called a charitable remainder trust and a family limited partnership.
Oh, my goodness.
And when I asked her some questions, which I thought might be important, she said that they hadn't really mentioned any of that stuff. So it kind of bothered me.
Well, Chris, I think instead of the Hawaiian music, we're going to need to go to the sirens.
Yeah.
All kinds of red flags going up here.
All kinds. I've been to a number of these conferences, very similar to what your mom went to. And they're not scams in the sense of being illegal, in the traditional sense that we'll use the word scam. But what they are, they're products that are sold but should not be bought. They're very expensive. My bottom line advice to anybody who's tempted to go to one of these seminars, stay away from them, because what they're selling is that Uncle Sam won't tax you. Or, yeah, you can make 50% on your money off of people who have fallen into trouble with their homes. And, you know, if any of these programs really worked the way that they're pitched, we'd all be rich.
So Sean, is this something that your mother has already made the investment?
Well, unfortunately, she did make an investment in a couple of these things, and they claim that they are full get your money back. And
yeah,
as soon as I heard about it, I urged her to try and get her money back as much as she could. But hopefully she actually can.
Yeah. Did they set any sort of time limit on getting her money back?
On one of the programs that she bought into, they had a 3-day time limit.
Uh-oh.
And I haven't talked to her since, but I believe that she tried to get her money back within that time period.
Okay. Chris, do you know, in general, legally, are they required to give you your money back if you change your mind?
What they have to do is state what is the program. You have 3 days, you have a week, you have 2 weeks. They have a fair amount of latitude as long as it's clearly understood. Now, the elderly can get some extra protections. And so I think it's great that she's trying to get her money back. And here's the real thing. Even if you can't get all your money back, don't put good money after bad. Just write it off, move away, walk on.
All right. Does that help you out, Sean?
It helps me out quite a bit. I will
All
make
right.
sure to let my mother know.
Good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, unfortunately, Chris, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But as we've been telling folks, you are now answering their personal finance questions every weekday online. Just visit our website. It's at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Confession time. A few weeks ago, I made a major math boo-boo on air in front of millions of people. I was calculating a percentage, and I forgot to move the decimal point over two places. Believe it or not, I actually got A's and B's in the subject, but for many, many people, math is just scary. Too bad you can't go through life without it. The National Mathematics Advisory Panel recently issued a report saying students who complete Algebra 2 are more than twice as likely to graduate from college. It recommended that students be required to learn fewer math topics, but to learn them more in depth. Here to talk math and finance is Jean Chatsky. She's the author of Make Money, Not Excuses. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How many of us are truly affected by what you might call math anxiety?
When it comes to women, the numbers go as high as half, and I've seen different pieces of research on the subject. Men tend to be a little bit less affected, but the problem is that this starts very, very early in childhood. You could have one instance, one teacher who called on you when your hand was not raised and sent you to the blackboard to solve a problem that you didn't understand. You get embarrassed, you get very shy of the math very quickly, and it only takes once, but the ramifications can actually last for a lifetime.
If you have decided, either in your head or found out for real, that you're not good at math, how does that affect you in your personal finances?
It can be serious because you tend to avoid dealing with your money. And if we're avoiding dealing with the money because we don't like to look at the numbers, then we're not opening our statements. We're not saving and calculating what it might cost us to live in retirement, and we're going to end up down the line with a huge shortfall.
When we talk about math anxiety in relation to personal finances, are we talking about folks being afraid of even, you know, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division? Or are we talking, you know, you can't calculate something to the fourth power off the top of your head?
I think that the fear tends to be of the fourth power. But what people don't realize is that the sort of math that was required in the classroom is not at all the sort of math that is required in real life.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of math that you need for money is addition, subtraction, multiplication, percentages, and fractions. And that's it.
percentages and fractions. I think that's where you might get people.
Okay, but we all have shortcuts that are available to us that were not available to other generations. Every one of us these days carries around a cell phone, and there's a calculator in there. So we should be pulling out the calculators and using them. Or if we don't like to balance our checkbooks, then we should be banking online and letting the bank run all of those computations that we want to avoid for us.
Aside from getting yourself a financial advisor, what are some other steps that you can take if you're one of the, if you're a math phobic and you just really don't feel comfortable with working with your own finances?
Small steps can be very, very helpful. A lot of local colleges, a lot of even local community colleges these days offer remedial math courses. The internet can also be a great tool. If you can get yourself to one or more of the retirement calculators, you run yourself through a few of them and you start to get sort of a consensus opinion of how much money you are going to need to have to afford the sort of retirement that you are thinking in your mind you might want. Lastly, if you are not certain, don't let that stop you from starting to save. Go ahead and save some money and put it in a life cycle fund or a target date retirement fund. That's a mutual fund set up to essentially manage itself toward your retirement date. And these funds can truly be a lifesaver because they are for all those people out there who just don't get up to the plate to make their own decisions.
It seems like our financial lives, that's kind of one area of ourselves that we don't share a lot with friends. You kind of talk about anything but money. But I wonder if that's also a way for you to kind of get over the math phobias. Talking to other people who probably have the same issues and maybe you can learn together.
I think that's absolutely right. I actually saw a piece of research that came out from the Consumer Federation of America and Wachovia. It looked at savings and the fact that more than half of the people in this country are not saving adequately. When it looked at the drivers of good saving behavior, 80% of people said communicating about financial goals, communicating about our money and what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong was actually a huge help in getting moving in the right direction.
Jean Chatzky is the author of Make Money, Not Excuses. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, credit card loyalty programs aren't exactly loyal to you these days.
You have to use a lot more points, so you have to spend a lot more money to get your free iPod.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement.
American Public Media.